Good evening. Oh, thank you. I'm not used to such an immediate response. Thank you. Well, it is my distinct honor to welcome you to the 2010 Priestley Celebration. Each year since 1952, we have gathered to present this award to a distinguished scientist in memory of Joseph Priestley, the discoverer of oxygen, and an early friend of Dickinson College. The presentation of this award gives us the occasion to commemorate Dickinson's revolutionary heritage. It also symbolizes our strong commitment to the advancement of sciences as an integral and central focus of a liberal arts curriculum, a commitment that is demonstrated through our vibrant and innovative faculty and our state-of-the-art science facilities. As many of you know, our founder, Dr. Benjamin Rush, was a true revolutionary in many aspects of his life. Rush was not only a leader in the fight for American independence, but also championed many societal causes of the day and was equally forward-looking in his thoughts on education and his vision for Dickinson College. To Rush, a broadly educated citizenry was absolutely essential to the success of the New Republic. Dickinson students were, however, to receive an education that was markedly different from that offered in Europe, specifically England. The new nation demanded a new approach to education, and Dickinson College was founded with the express purpose of delivering a distinctively American liberal arts, pragmatic, useful curriculum. As the country's foremost physician, Rush instinctively knew the role that scientific knowledge and discovery would play in shaping the new nation, and he, in fact, expected science to play a central organizing role in Dickinson's curriculum. It was the sciences, Rush firmly believed, that would help students most readily connect to emerging knowledge. It was this aspect that knowledge in America would be constantly building on itself. It would no longer be static. It was the sciences that would ultimately realign to create new fields of thought that crossed and merged existing disciplines, early understanding of interdisciplinarity. It should come as no surprise that Dr. Rush actively sought out other revolutionary thinkers of the day. One of them was Joseph Priestley. Priestley was born in Leeds, England in 1733. Although he prepared for a career in ministry, he had a deep and active fascination with science. After meeting Benjamin Franklin in London, Priestley conducted a series of experiments on electricity. And in fact, although it was Franklin who actually conducted the now famous, infamous experiment with a kite, a key, and lightning, proving that lightning was a discharge of electricity, it was in fact Priestley who first described the experiment in print in his 1766 book about electricity. But wisely, he let Franklin be the first experimenter. All right. Very astute. Later, Priestley turned to investigations of what he termed different types of air. And if you remember, Rush was fascinated with the air in Carlisle. He thought the air by the War College was swampish, morbid, and therefore that's why the college is here and not over there. That air that's coming from the War College. Okay. These explorations led to the discovery of 9 gases, including sulfur dioxide, ammonium, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, and a gas later named oxygen. It should be noted that his work with carbon dioxide included the process of fusing CO2 into water and thus inventing carbonation. Hence, soda bottlers have long celebrated Priestley's fine contributions, and we deal today with the problem of sugar in carbonation. Priestley's increasingly unorthodox views on theology, coupled with his outspoken opposition to the English slave trade, ultimately forced him to flee to America in 1794. Already well known for his scientific accomplishments, it was only a matter of time before Priestley would form a close friendship with the nation's foremost physician, Benjamin Rush. They would dine often in Philadelphia. Rush's letters contain numerous references to his delightful dinners and encounters with his new acquaintance. Joseph Priestley was every bit as dedicated to improving the condition of humankind as Rush, even visiting Rush in Philadelphia during the yellow fever epidemic. Priestley went right into it. As Rush stayed, despite most of the other physicians fleeing, Rush stayed, Priestley came. Although Dr. Priestley died only 10 years after arriving in America, his relationship with Rush and his connection to Dickinson College continued when his friend Thomas Cooper was appointed the first professor of natural philosophy and chemistry in 1811. That's Ed Dickinson, with the strong support of Dr. Rush. Cooper was as much of a revolutionary thinker as Joseph Priestley and Benjamin Rush, and his forward-thinking political and religious views made his relations with Dickinson's president, Jeremiah Atwater, particularly contentious. His relationship with Atwater, who was, by the way, the first president of Middlebury College, became so strained that Cooper remained at the college for only 4 years. Atwater himself did not remain for very long either. And in fact, the former president of Middlebury College, when visiting Dickinson a few years ago, made the very delightful statement that Jeremiah Atwater was not a very good president of Middlebury, and he wasn't a very good president of Dickinson. And Mr. Cooper had a habit which Jeremiah, as a very devout person, objected to. Mr. Cooper would, in the evening, take a few nips with the students. And that Jeremiah Atwater would not tolerate. Although his time at Dickinson was relatively short, Cooper left a lasting legacy by arranging for the acquisition of much of Priestley's scientific apparatus, thereby ensuring that Dickinson students would have state-of-the-art scientific equipment with which to work, learn, and advance society. The same equipment is still in Dickinson College's archive. The Dickinson College Award in memory of Joseph Priestley honors a distinguished scientist for discoveries that contribute to the betterment of humankind. This occasion is indeed a celebration. It is a celebration of Dickinson's historic legacy, its strong commitment to scientific education and advancement, and the creativity and vision that is carried on in the Priestley tradition by all those distinguished individuals who are selected to receive this prestigious award. I can say that when I was at Dickinson, I will remember this distinctively. Linus Pauling, Margaret Mead, on and on. Incredible moments. As you're sitting there, I sat there and had the opportunity to hear these wonderful, wonderful people speak and share their knowledge. It is therefore appropriate that we honor this year's recipient, Professor Stephen Sparks, for his groundbreaking, it's a very good pun, his groundbreaking work in the fields such as petrology and volcanology, and for improving our understanding of the dynamics of volcanic systems. I would now like to ask Professor Ben Edwards, Associate Professor of Earth Sciences, to come to the podium to introduce our honoree and speaker. Ben?
Good evening and welcome to come with us, visit tonight, and help celebrate the accomplishments of one of the real leaders in the field of a very important aspect of Earth Sciences, and that is the study of volcanoes. They're exciting to watch, but also sometimes dangerous. And Professor Sparks is being honored in part because he really has an unusual ability amongst a lot of the sciences to take basic physics and chemistry and complicated math and use them to understand processes that are sometimes unseen. They're occurring inside the Earth, or they occur so fast that they're hard to observe and sometimes even dangerous to observe. Professor Sparks started off his education at Imperial College, where he received his bachelor's degree and his PhD. And his PhD supervisor was another volcanologist named George Walker, who was really one of the founders of the modern field of volcanology. Professor Sparks has traveled many places. He spent time in the United States for a few years as a NATO scholar at the University of Rhode Island. Then he went to Cambridge for several years, where he was a lecturer in geology and a fellow at Trinity Hall. And then in 1989, he went to his present position at the University of Bristol, where he is the Channing Wills Chair of Geology at the University of Bristol. He's been a visiting scholar at places like the California Institute of Technology, Yale University, and he's a fellow and a leader in many scientific societies, including, as was Joseph Priestley, a fellow of the Royal Society. And I was listening, of course, and learning more about Benjamin Rush just a few moments ago. And one of the things that I was able to draw immediately were some interesting connections between Franklin and Priestley. And Professor Sparks, I think, has a little bit of both. He has some of the daring of Benjamin Franklin because he actually conducts the dangerous experiments. as we'll see tonight, and goes to places that, are exciting. But he doesn't neglect the writing as well. He's written over 300 papers, published over 300 papers in scientific literature, and those papers have been cited over 10,000 times. So it's very much a privilege and honor for me tonight to introduce Professor Stephen Sparks to tell us about volcanic eruptions.
Thanks very much, President and Ben, for very kind introductions. And it's a great pleasure to be here in Pennsylvania at Dickinson College. What I'm going to try and do tonight is to try and give you some flavor of why we have volcanoes on the Earth, how the volcanoes work, looking at the sort of basic ideas of their dynamics and the way they erupt, and then progress a little bit into how we monitor volcanoes through to some of the societal implications of having volcanoes and some of the issues that really start to become very interdisciplinary and very much related to how we deal with volcanoes in the modern world. Well, start with Joseph Priestley. I, of course, did read up a little bit about him before I came. We do share some commonality in that I was brought up in a place called Chester, near to Nantwich, where Priestley was worked. And then I spent some time as a teenager quite close to Leeds, where Priestley was also present. But there, I think the comparisons unfortunately end. Here's, of course, a couple of science links between Priestley's fundamental science and Franklin's fundamental science and volcanoes. This is lightning from the recent eruption of Eyjafjallajökull. Volcanoes are great ways of forming lightning, and of course, that's what Priestley, as the president said, well, Priestley and Franklin were very famous for some of the very fundamental first research on electricity and lightning. And of course, volcanic gases, as you'll see during the talk, are absolutely fundamental to understanding how volcanoes work. And you'll see that some of the ideas that Priestley had about the soda fountain, inventing the soda fountain, have a huge relevance to understanding how a volcano works. So a lot of the gases that Priestley discovered are being chucked out of Hawaii here. And I got this nice quote from which was from The Role of the Scientist for the Security and Happiness of Mankind. That's a Priestley quote. Okay, so what I'd like to do is to try and give you some impression of, firstly, why we have volcanoes on the Earth at all. I suspect most of you will be pretty familiar with the modern idea of plate tectonics to explain why we get earthquakes and volcanoes. We know that the outer surface of the Earth is cold and rigid. It's the rocky planet on which we live. And, of course, this outer cold region, around 100 kilometres thick, is broken up into big plates. And these plates move around with respect to each other. Sometimes the plates will pull apart and sometimes they'll crash together. And so if we look at down here in the Indian plate, for example, these plates are being pulled apart. And where the Nazca plate collides with South America, they're being pushed apart. And we, of course, know that there's a coincidence between these plate boundaries, between earthquakes and volcanoes at this plate boundaries. In fact, it's that observation that partly led to the modern ideas of plate tectonics. And this is a very simplified cross-section of through the Earth and the tectonic plates. As I said, we're used to living on a cold, rocky surface, but of course we know that actually if we go down only about 100 kilometres beneath where we are now, the rocks will be extraordinarily hot. They'll probably be at about well over 1,000 degrees centigrade. So most of the Earth's interior is hot. But it is not molten. That's a misconception. Most of the Earth is solid until you get to the core. But what's also true is that the solid Earth is also extremely hot, except very close to the surface. And it's just like a glacier. When you get very hot solid materials like a glacier, it's definitely ice and it's a solid, a glacier. But of course, it's capable of flowing down a mountain, and it's capable of flow because it's very close to its melting temperature. And the inside of the Earth, most of the Earth is like that. It's very close to a bit below the melting temperature. And so the reason we have volcanoes at all is because of that. It means that it doesn't take very much to make the inside of the Earth melt. And the places it melts most often are where the plates are being pulled apart, like in the middle of the Atlantic. So this part of the plate, often called the lithosphere, is being pulled apart. And I'll show you in a bit more detail what goes on there. And we get volcanoes on the ocean floor where the plates are being pulled apart. And where the plates are pushing against one another, one of the plates goes back into the Earth. And we'll see that water plays a huge role in melting the rocks down there and causing volcanoes. So most volcanoes are to do with the plate. So let's have a look a little bit at trying to understand why we get volcanoes at the ridges. So often if we go underneath the water or we go to somewhere like Hawaii, we see 1,200 degrees centigrade basalt coming out. All the way along the ocean ridges we get volcanoes. And see, this basalt is coming from really quite shallow, about 100 kilometres depth. And what's happening is as the plates are pulled apart at the ocean ridges, and you can see the scale here, what happens is this very, very hot mantle, the Earth's interior, flows up into the gap caused by the plates being pulled apart. Now, the main point, of course, is that there's a strong relationship between pressure and where a substance melts. We know that if we go up to the top of the Himalayas, the boiling point of water is quite a lot less. And so the point really is that down here, perhaps 100 or 200 kilometres deep, it's extremely hot, and the rocks are very close to their melting temperature. And so when they rise up beneath where the plates are being pulled apart, the pressure goes down and the rocks spontaneously melt. So that's the main reason we get most volcanoes on the Earth, is this spontaneous core of hot material welling up, hot solid material welling up to close to the Earth's surface. And this happens mostly at... and that's what actually the material looks like, this green... This is the green mineral of olivine, which makes up most of the Earth's mantle. This is a bit technical, but if you just look here, it's temperature on this axis, and this is pressure. The pressure down in the Earth on this side, we're going down 50, 100, 150 kilometres. And won't go into the great details, but you can see this curve here. This is the temperature at which the Earth's interior first starts to melt. And you can see that as we go deeper in the Earth, the temperature at which it starts to melt gets higher and higher. So we go down to 150 kilometres, and you can see that the temperature it first starts to melt is several hundred degrees hotter. So what happens is down there, we may have some, deep in the Earth, we might have some hot material at 1,400 degrees centigrade. It comes up because it flows up as the plates pull apart, and then it comes up and it hits the melting temperature, the first point of melting, and it melts. And that's essentially why we get the volcanoes where the plates pull apart. Now, in detail, the melting is quite remarkable that you can see here all these little crystals. If you go down there, you see these tiny little green... Or you would, if you were able to go down there, like Jules Verne, you would see these tiny little crystals. And these crystals melt at the edges. This is on a sort of millimetre scale. And little tiny droplets of melt form on the edges of between the crystals and form a network. And this melt, because this melt is less dense than the crystals, this melt has a force which makes the melt try and go upwards, whereas the solid stays where it is. And so these little tiny pockets of melt are squeezed out. Imagine something like a bath sponge. You put it in your bath, and you take it out and you squeeze it. And, of course, the liquid water comes out of all the little pores in the sponge. And that's very much what happens. So, as I say, in the main places where the plates pull apart, that's what makes the volcanoes. And a little bit of an analogy here. I'm not sure. This is a pint of Guinness. I think you can do it with the different things as well. But because different sorts of liquid, but these are crystals, and then the brown is the little bits of melt in between schematically. And what happens is if you've got dense crystals and you've got light melt, the melt wants to go upwards because it's lower in density, and the crystals want to go downwards, and they segregate, and so we get a pure melt at the top. And it's a very similar to you draw a pint of Guinness or you draw a soda and you've got bubbles mixed up with liquid, the same principles, and the bubbles want to rise to the top and the liquid wants to go down to the bottom. And I think if you've ever done this, you'll notice that actually it looks like little waves happen when you some sorts of that you'll see little waves, and these are called solitons. They're actually the separation of the light and the dense creates waves in the system. And so that's the principle. That's how the melt gets out. And once it's got out and separated, it rushes to the surface and we get a Y or whatever. Okay, and this is Iceland in, of course, very topical at the moment. This is where this is where North America and Europe are gradually separating. We're separating at the moment at, just we speak, at 2 centimetres per year. That's what's happening at the moment. And there's a split down Iceland. It's one of the few places where the volcanoes underwater get to the Earth's surface. And there are these splits and lots of beautiful volcanoes. And you can see this from an eruption in Iceland at the time when the actual split took place. And then, again, this melt rushing up from depth, where it's separated, produces beautiful eruptions. So that's what's happening in Iceland where the plates form. And, of course, this happens repeatedly over thousands or tens of thousands or millions of years. It's taken at this rate, the width of the Atlantic can be explained by about 60 million years of these plates slowly moving apart. Okay, well, we've got, just to show you that we've got, there are other places, another place where things are splitting apart is in Ethiopia. And this is part of Africa is splitting apart, and there's a lot of volcanoes through Kenya and Ethiopia which go up here. And this is a place where the volcanoes are splitting apart and new ocean is forming. So this is a very young example of a plate boundary which is pulling apart. And there's been a lot of activity, eruptions along here. These orange things are the sort of volcanic centres. And I just wanted to show you this because this is, it just shows you the wonder of modern technology. These are all the earthquakes along the split. This is about 60 kilometres, that's lat and long, but this is about 60 kilometres long. This happened in 2000, 2009. And these are all the earthquakes. And you see these little pattern, these looks like a sort of fringes. This is radar altimetry, where you take a radar image of the Earth's surface, and then you wait a few weeks, and you take another radar image, and the two topographies are different, and you take one from the other, and you get an interference pattern. And so this is the interference pattern associated with the uplift of the Earth, associated with the two plates pulling apart. So in 2007 and 2009, this side of Ethiopia and that side separated by 8 metres, along a distance of about 100 kilometres. So that's what happened. Now, of course, it doesn't happen very often because the average is around 2 or 3 centimetres per year. So every several hundred years, this plate boundary splits several metres. And that's what you can see. Now, each of those fringes is 10 centimetres of uplift. So you can see that this part of Ethiopia lifted up by probably, count the fringes, something like a metre during this splitting apart. So we've got great modern science techniques to, and that's actually just a close-up of one of these satellite images. This is a new, relatively recent new technology that you can apply to volcanoes. So this is a picture of the Ethiopian Rift, and you can see all the fractures and faults associated with these two sides of the plates splitting apart. Okay, well, that explains, hopefully, explains volcanoes where you get the plates pulling apart. Why do you get volcanoes where the plates collide together? At first sight, it's a bit odd because, okay, this is that diagram again. You can see one plate is pushed against the other. And just to perhaps give you the idea, when you get two plates colliding, one of them will slide underneath the other and will be pushed back into the Earth. And, of course, that plate's been at the Earth's surface for a long time, tens of millions or hundreds of millions of years, and it's cold. So it seems a bit odd to push things down and make things melt. Well, the answer to that is actually the same reason that ice melts when you put salt on it in the winter if you have a solid material and you add certain kinds of chemical, it'll lower the melting temperature. So in the winter, you have ice on the road and you put salt on the road because the salt, the sodium chloride, makes the melting temperature of the ice decrease, and so the ice melts and you don't get frozen roads. Well, basically, that's the same reason that we get melting at the ridges. Now, when we have to go back to where the plates pull apart on the ocean floor, what's been another big discovery in the earth sciences is that where you pull the plates apart, you've got hot volcanoes and you've got seawater, and they mix together, and you get on the seafloor what are called black smokers. These are hot springs at hundreds of degrees centigrade discharging everywhere along the plate boundaries where the hot water meets the lava coming up. And we get these black smokers, and the rocks up here get hydrated. They change their chemistry. They absorb water by these chemical reactions. Now, when the plate goes down, this water, the plate, the cold plate, but now full of water, releases its water and releases it into the hot rocks above. And the main point is that water acts on the Earth's materials just like salt does on the ice and the roads. It makes the rocks melt. And again, I'm just going to perhaps just look at this diagram. This is pressure against temperature. And this is a sort of rock that makes up most of the Earth. We don't need to worry about the name. But this is the change of melting temperature with increasing pressure without water in it. And this is the change of melting temperature with water in it. And what you can see is that putting a little bit of water down here reduces the melting temperature of the inside of the Earth by hundreds of degrees centigrade. So essentially what happens is the plate goes down, it gets heated up, the hydrated minerals break down and they release their water, and then these hot rocks there melt. That melt separates and we get volcanoes. So it's the water, pushing water back into the Earth, that causes the volcanoes that actually perhaps are like Mount St. Helens. And again, just to show you some of the beautiful modern results that we now have, ways of imaging the Earth, this is Japan. And in Japan, all the volcanoes like Mount Fuji are caused by the plate going down, and we can image underneath the volcano using seismology. These red patches are places where the rocks are melting, and so they've got unusual seismic properties. And you can image this just like you can do a CAT scan of a human body. You can make an image using seismic waves, and you can find out what the constitution is of the deeper Earth. And so we find that underneath these volcanoes are this is this hot zone feeding and this hot zone here, or this red zone here, is again caused by the release of water, making the rocks here melt and forming the volcanoes. Okay, and this is just another image of the same data. This is a cross section, and this shows you two things. Firstly, here's some volcanoes in Japan. Just look at one of these. Here's the volcanoes. Here's the plate going down. And you can see here that the earthquakes mark out the top of the plate. So you can image the plate. The plate's going down, and the top of it's having friction with the rocks above, and we get lots of earthquakes, and we can image those. So we can see, we can actually see the plate, and then we can see these red blobs are where the melt is being produced by the release of water. And so the earthquakes show the subducted plate, and so what's called seismic tomography shows where the melt is. So we can really get a very nice, these days we can get very nice images of the inside of the Earth and see these processes going on. Now, okay, well, we've produced some melt. We're okay, we've produced some melt, and that melt's going to rise up and try and get to the Earth's surface. But it doesn't always work out that way. As the melt rises up in the cold crust and the cold rocks near the Earth's surface, it gets stuck, and it's a bit of a battle for the magma to actually get up and cause an eruption. And so what happens is sometimes it gets stuck in various ways and forms what we call intrusions, And if we get a lot of magma getting stuck, we get what's called a magma chamber in the crust. And then that's why we can get big eruptions, because if the magma just continually leaked to the Earth's surface, we'd expect it just to leak out slowly all the time. And it doesn't do that. It gets stuck, and it has to build up pressure and has to build up these things we called magma chambers underneath the volcanoes. And if we go to the somewhere in the Antarctica, for example, we can see where the magma gets stuck. It often gets stuck in the layers of rock in the Earth, and here's a layer of magma in Antarctica between some limestones. And this is an experiment that we did to try and understand how the magma gets stuck. And so what we did is we got some jelly, and we made one jelly a bit stronger than the other jelly, and we found that here's the magma coming up, or the liquid in our experiment, this is water, and it gets to the layer where it goes from stronger to less strong rock, and it has a pronounced tendency to spread out, not to get to the surface, but to spread out and form layers very much like the one you can see in Antarctica. And so we think this is very important. Now, I'm now going to go and show you a little bit about some more specific work, and I'm going to talk a little bit about an eruption in the Caribbean and start looking through some of the mechanisms of eruption. So now we've got the magma. It sometimes gets stuck, but sometimes it gets to the Earth's surface and we get eruptions. So how do these eruptions work? So the place I'm going to use in particular tonight is a little volcano, well, it's not quite so little, called Soufre Hills Volcano in Montserrat in the Caribbean. You can just about, there's Trinidad down here, and this is located up in the northern Lesser Antilles. It's an island about 12 kilometres long and about 7 kilometres wide, and it had a huge eruption in, this is the lava from this, in 1995 right through to the present. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about this. Again, we can get great images. This is earthquake data. This is the island, and you can see each dot is a located earthquake. And you can see that here's the volcano, and we can see fractures in the earth outlined by the earthquakes, and we can map these earthquakes underground in three dimensions and tell something about where the magma is and where the magma chamber is located. So from this sort of data, we can say some nice things. We can say there's a magma chamber, a place where the magma gets stuck at about 5 kilometres depth. That's the source of the volcano. And when this particular volcano erupted, the earthquakes that you see from 5 kilometres to depth of the surface are essentially the magma forcing its way to the surface. And as it does so, the earthquakes are caused by breaking rock. You can imagine there's a lot of energy in forcing rocks apart, and that's why we get lots of earthquakes. So we can see that really very nicely here in this data. And you can again get great results. By the way, I should say Montserrat is a place I should have mentioned where two plates are colliding. The Atlantic plate is pushing underneath the Caribbean plate, and we get the volcanoes due to this water mechanism I mentioned there. And this is the volcano itself, and it's not like Hawaii. It's a great big, what we call a dome. It's what's called an andesite lava. This is about 850 degrees centigrade stuck at the top. And this just gives you some of the sorts of methods. So this is one of my PhD students who's measuring laser light between her and a mirror on the volcano. She bounces the laser light out, and if the volcano swells or something happens inside the volcano, the length of that line changes. And this diagram here that you can see is meant to show you if you have a magma chamber underneath a volcano, when the pressure in the magma chamber goes up, it's a swelling, so it's a big pot of molten rock underground. And when the pressure goes up, the rocks are uplifted, and they're pushed apart. And you can see here that the surface of the Earth is pushed apart and pushed upwards, and when the pressure goes down, it subsides. And so you can tell from both the horizontal and the vertical motions, and using techniques like this, what's happening. And this just shows you some wonderful data, which is really very, I think, simple to understand. I'll just show you what you're looking at. This is a GPS station on the volcano. So I'm at one particular place. And this is the relative height of this GPS station. So when these dots are going downwards, you can notice the time, that's 1996, 2001. When these dots are going downwards, I'm sinking. And so over these few years, the ground sank by about half a meter or so. When the dots go up, then the ground is lifting up and then sinking again. So the ground is going up and down at one particular place. And this is our measurements of the amount of lava erupted. We can look at this lava and we can watch it grow and increase in volume, and we can measure those. And here's our data on the volume of the lava. And you can see that there's a period when the lava is coming out of the volcano, and you'll notice the ground is subsiding. So what's happening? We've got a big balloon of magma underground. We're erupting liquid out of that balloon. The pressure's going down, and the balloon is collapsing, and the ground is subsiding. And then we get to a very interesting point where there was about 18 months with no eruption at all. There was no eruption at the surface, but the ground is going up. And you can see now, of course, what's happening is the pressure is now building up. The magma can't get out, so the pressure builds up and the ground lifts up. And then as soon as lava starts coming out again, the ground collapses. Well, that's pretty interesting. It's very simple, I think, to understand, but also very practical. During this period, when we were working in the observatory, the local people said, well, there's nothing happening at the volcano. We've been evacuated. Why can't we all go home? And, of course, the answer was the scientific measurements of the GPS were telling us that the volcano is very much alive and it would not be sensible for the people to be relocated back to from where they'd been evacuated. So that gives you perhaps some insight into some of the practical aspects. This is another volcano I've been working on in Bolivia. It's the world's largest volcanic deformation. It's a very poorly known volcano called Uturungu in southern Bolivia. And not much was known about it until this new technology came about. This is in the radar image. It's just like the East Africa. But now you can see that triangle is this volcano here. And you can see there's a nice interference pattern by measuring the topography with radar from month to month. And this whole area is uplifting at over 70 kilometers wide. It's uplifting at about 3 centimeters per year. So this is the biggest volcanic deformation area on Earth. And so we're pretty interested, of course, of finding out what's happening there. Okay, so you've seen some of the technology. I'll now try and explain a little bit about the sorts of activity that happens on a volcano. And volcanoes sometimes explode and sometimes produce lava. So the question is why? Sometimes the molten rock just oozes out and sometimes it explodes. And what you can see here is it sort of goes back to Priestley in a way. You can see here water, which is the main volcanic gas, and you can see its solubility in molten rock as a function of pressure. So this is a solubility curve. We don't know the details, but we don't need to know about the details, but the point is, of course, you make soda water or Coca-Cola or what is it by forcing carbon dioxide to dissolve in the liquid under high pressure, and then when the pressure, you open your can, the pressure goes down and the bubbles come out. And that's what, of course, happens in a volcano. And you can see here that there's a very strong... water is very soluble in molten rock at modest pressures, but completely insoluble at the Earth's surface. And this is an experiment we did in our labs where we reproduce this. If you have some resin, pine resin, and you dissolve some acetone in it, and you take the pressure off, it bubbles up violently and furiously, and you can monitor them. So that's what you're seeing. You're seeing some pine resin, molten pine resin with some acetone dissolved in it. We take the pressure off and it bubbles up. Now, in a volcano, it does that. Here's the magma chamber. Here's the molten rock. And this process, with this amount of water, is enough to power gigantic eruptions. And so we have very, very strong explosive eruptions. The magma bubbles up, it breaks apart, and then it jets into the Earth's atmosphere at very high velocity of hundreds of meters per second from just the force of the gas bubbles bubbling out of the molten rock. So I guess this comes right back to Priestley and soda waters. It's the same sort of physical principles. Now, once it gets out on the Earth's surface, it can do two things, and I've illustrated this here. So I want you to imagine that you're at the back of a jet engine, and the jet engine, you're forcing gas, and in this case, broken up particles, out of the back of the jet engine at hundreds of meters per second. When that happens, this jet, in the back of an engine or in a volcano, mixes with air. And it turns out that this mixing ingests air, cold air, and the cold air does two things. One is the cold air is still, so when we drag it into the jet slows down because we have a momentum transfer between the cold air and the jet. So the first thing it does is it slows things down. The second thing is because the jet in a volcano is made of very hot ash at 1,000 degrees centigrade, the air is heated and expands and becomes buoyant. And so there's a competition between the heating of the air, the slowing of the air, and also the fact that the particles in the particles add mass to the jet and can make it dense. And so we get two styles of activity in volcanoes. Either the heating winds and the eruption column goes up to some gigantic height, 30 or 40 kilometers like this, as in this experiment, or the density of the particles and the dragging in of air wins, and we get a collapse of the eruption column, and at a very low altitude, perhaps a few hundred meters, the whole thing collapses down, and we get a flow across the Earth's surface, a very dangerous sort of flow of hot gas and ash. And so we've got a sort of either-or scenario. In reality, of course, it's a bit more complicated, and sometimes it does both at the same time. But the principle here is that it's like a jet, and that's how we understand what sort of eruption goes on. So here's a couple of examples. This is a small volcano in Chile. The heating of the air winds, so the stuff goes up, and we get a big eruption column. This is the Philippines. This is the biggest eruption of the last century, Mount Pinatubo in 1991. That's the cloud spreading out at 35 kilometers altitude with a diameter of about 500 kilometers of diameter. That's how powerful things are. In the case of Pinatubo, the cloud went up to 35 kilometers, produced this giant flow in the atmosphere that you can see in a satellite image. So that's the first style. Now, this isn't, it's sort of dangerous, but not terribly dangerous, except if you're in an aeroplane, as we'll come on to later on. That's if it goes all the way up, that's not too bad. But this is definitely what you want to avoid if you live round a volcano, is this phenomena, that the material goes up, the dragging, the loss of momentum of the jet, and the particles win, and the flow goes down the side of the volcano like that. Right, so I'm going to show you a film from Montserrat. This is an example of both happening, because when the jet comes out of the volcano, you'll see this in the film, when the jet comes out, part of it mixes with enough air to become hot and buoyant and rises up to a great height, and other bits are too dense. They rise up a bit, a few hundred meters, and they collapse down and produce one of these terrible floats. So I'll just... This is one of the explosions on Montserrat. That's about 500 meters high. And this is the collapsing bit. This is the part of the jet which is too dense and it's collapsing down the volcano. And it's moving about 100 kilometers per hour. You definitely don't want to be in the way.
Be careful, guys.
And that's my friend David Lee, who made the film with. And this is the bit that this is where the heating the air, this bit of the eruption column, heats the air and will go up to 14 kilometres high. So that's the bit where the buoyancy wins. You see, in this case, there's a bit of both going on. So this is what's called a pyroclastic flow, and it is the biggest volcanic hazard of them all.
This is the unbelievable volcano.
That's David again, waxing lyrical.
Well, this is the top of the eruption column as the sun hits it at maybe 12,000 feet or so. I'm amazed. Totally, totally amazed.
That was the voice of my good friend David Lee, who's a videographer on Montserrat, and we produced a film together about the eruption. But that's certainly in one bit of film. You see those two. Those are the two big sorts of explosive eruptions that you get on volcanoes, and it's all to do with how jets behave. Now the other aspect is, let's have a look at this. These are lava flows. So we know that these magmas always have a lot of gas in them, but they don't always explode. So why not? Why does the lava sometimes come out as just lava and sometimes explode? Well, without going into great detail, the main thing is that gases can leak out of magma as it rises. So if magma comes up very fast, the gas doesn't have time to leak out and we explode. If the gas comes up rather more slowly, the gases coming out of solution and forming the bubbles can leak away, and you never get a big enough pressure to have an explosion, and the magma then ends up at the Earth's surface just as lava with very little gas in it. And so we've got these two styles, and we noticed that we got different sorts of shape. If the flow rate was very low, we got these sort of strange spines. If it was a bit higher, we got shapes like this, and if it was a bit higher still, it formed pancakes. The lava came out and spread like a pancake. And then if the flow rate was very high, we got explosions. And so our field observation supported this idea. If it comes up slowly, it'll lose the gas and form a lava. If it comes up fast, it'll explode. And so we, of course, need to know a little bit more about that idea. And again, you can see some of these... This sort of activity. And here's some of the... just perhaps look at this one. This is one of the pyroclastic flows going into the sea on Montserrat. And this is one of the bigger... Also, another thing that can happen is the whole dome can collapse as well. So the dome itself is very unstable. OK. Bit complicated, but I want to get across the idea. This is the of why it is that volcanoes have these sorts of behaviour. And again, we have to go back to the solubility relationships. This is water versus pressure. And I made the point that in molten rock, if we go up to a pressure of what's called 2 kilobars, that's about 5 kilometres down, you can dissolve a lot of water in it. And at the Earth's surface, there's no water at all. So how can we explain that the magmas at a volcano like Montserrat come out as lava? We know they had a lot of water in them because we can look at the minerals in great detail, and we can see this particular mineral tells us that there must have been a lot of water in it down here, down beneath the volcano, but the water is lost. And so what happens is it's... perhaps I can explain it rather than going through that diagram. It's the opposite of putting salt on the earth. If you've got a rock where... molten rock where you've dissolved water in and the melting temperature's low, if you come up to the Earth's surface and the water escapes, the melting temperature goes up without the temperature changing. And so basically, it spontaneously solidifies. And so one of the effects is that when we go up rather slowly, the magma loses its gas and it turns back from a liquid to a solid as it comes up. No temperature change, it's just what people call a phase relationship. And essentially it'll go back to being a solid. And I think I'll just skip back to saying that if it comes up very slowly, as in this case, it forms a spine. That's like toothpaste coming out, squeezing some toothpaste and it coming out. It's almost solid. It's come up so slowly, it's had time for this phase change to occur completely, and it erupts as a solid. Whereas, of course, if it comes up fast, it doesn't have time, and so it produces the explosions. And again, this is really putting this idea in a very simple cartoon fashion. Fast flow, the gas bubbles come out, they build up, high pressures, we get an explosion. Slow flow rate, gas leaks out, and the magma erupts as lava. Well, just move a little bit forward. And I want to take you through this just a little bit carefully, because I want to get an idea of how an understanding of the science helps us monitor the volcano and manage the crisis. Now, let's have a look at this. Now, you can see this little wiggly curve, and that's the only one I'm going to really tell you anything about. What it is, that wiggly curve, is a pressure meter called a tilt meter. We put it on the side of the volcano, and it's like a spirit level. When the volcano pressure goes up, it's like, you know, imagine a spirit level, it goes up like that, and the angle changes. And when the pressure goes down, it goes back. And so that wiggly line is our instrument on the volcano. And the main thing I want you to see in this, never mind the little wiggles, look at the big trends. You can see that, and look at the time scale. This is June, July, August. This is about 2 months of data. And you can see that there's dramatic changes in this instrument going up and down. So that's just the observation. Now, the second observation is that whenever there's a big eruption on the volcano, it happens within a few hours or a day or two of this change. And this is an example of what this activity produced. And June the 25th, 25 people were killed by the volcano when this pyroclastic flow came down, and this is the capital of Plymouth. So how can we explain our observations? Okay. Well, there's a lot of systems in nature. I'm not sure how many mathematicians there are in the audience, but there's a lot of systems in nature which have what is called a hysteretic behavior. In other words, the system jumps from one state to another state very suddenly. And so here's our magma chamber, here's our flow to the Earth's surface, and here's our lava. And we would like to explain how the flow rate can fluctuate in some kind of cyclic way. And this is the pressure in the magma chamber driving the flow. Now, all I want you to notice is that this curve bends back and forward. And the main point is that the volcano can be exactly the same position, the same pressure, and it can have three different sorts of behavior, identical conditions. So it's a hysteretic system, and it's all to do with the fact this idea that as it loses its gas, the magma solidifies. And what happens is if it comes up too fast, then we lose the gas, but it comes up too fast, it loses the gas, but it hasn't got time to crystallize. So that's one sort of behavior. Second one, it comes up much more slowly. This time it loses its gas and it solidifies. And so we get two sorts of behavior, and the system can oscillate between a fast flow and a slow flow. And so what happens is as the pressure driving the flow goes up, it leaps up here, the flow rate is high, the pressure drops, and it goes round in a cycle. And we think that that is the explanation for what we see. We can see this tilt meter, this pressure meter, is showing us the natural cycling of the volcano. And what's happening is that when it gets to this point, it suddenly changes to fast flow. The volcano becomes very unstable. It starts to produce a lot of pyroclastic flows and erupt very quickly. And so our big eruptions are always associated with this kick or this cyclic behavior. So Of course, we can use this very nicely when on Montserrat, when we saw this pattern and started to understand it, we could say in these few weeks, everybody said, well, locals would say, the volcano is quiet, should we be worrying? We said, well, at the moment, we think the volcano's got this pattern, we think we understand it, and so we think in a week or two, it's quite likely to have a big eruption. So don't go home yet. Okay. Right, so I'm going to finish off by just doing back to the societal, Priestley's original thing that we have to be useful as scientists. This is us sitting around as a panel advising the British government and the Montserrat government about the hazards and risks from the volcano. And so this august panel would sit around and answer a question. There's a village 6 kilometres from the volcano. What's the chance that this village is going to be hit by one of these nasty pyroclastic flows? So that's the questions we would be asked by the governor of the island and the chief minister. So, why doesn't... And this is the sort of product. I'm not going to go in any sort of detail about it, but it's the sort of modern areas of natural hazards that we produce what's called a risk curve, a societal risk exposure curve. And I'll start off, before explaining this curve, I'll just show you a map of Montserrat. And you see that we've divided the map into different areas, and we know the populations of each of these areas. Here's the volcano. This is where people were living while the volcano was erupting. And, of course, the government of the island wanted to know if there's... would the volcano, in a certain state of activity, get pyroclastic flows to this place where people live, and should we evacuate? That's the question. And so what we can do is we can do a sort of modelling. We can put all our understanding of the volcanoes, the models, the observations, the processes, and we can come up with an uncertain probability that a flow would get into, say, Area 4. And then we can look at that in terms of the probability of a certain number of fatalities in 6 months versus the number of fatalities. So this is called a risk curve. So what this curve means, this red curve means, if you keep people in areas 4 and 5, the risk is pretty high. Our science is telling us there's about a 1 in 10 chance you're going to get several people killed. And it's probably worse than that because there were hundreds of, as you can imagine, if there are hundreds of people living where a pyroclastic flow goes, that's not good news. So what we do is we run the model, and the details don't matter. This band is something to do with our assessment of uncertainty. But then if we evacuate Area 4 and 5 and 3A, and we redo the calculations, we move people away from the volcano, and so it's much less likely that the pyroclastic flow will get up here, and our risk curve goes down there. And then if we move them even further away from the volcano, our risk curve goes down there. And so the chances of getting 10 people killed becomes very much lower. Now, as a governor of an island, you have to decide, well, what level of risk am I prepared to take as a governor? And what we did was to help the governor understand and the local people understand the risks they were facing. We compared this risk, the volcanic risk, with hurricane risk. So that blue curve is the risk. If you live in the Caribbean, that is your risk curve to hurricanes. There is always going to be a few people dying somewhere in the Caribbean from hurricanes, so it's a risk you accept by living in that part of the world, implicitly. And that's the risk from regional earthquakes. And so what we said, that if we evacuate people from these areas, then our risk curve will be comparable to the risk from hurricanes, which you sort of accept. Now, of course, it's still up to the governor to decide whether to evacuate or not, but it's a useful way of comparing the risks. Okay, my last topic is back to Benjamin Franklin and Joseph Priestley and lightning, but you all, I expect some of you, I know some of the Dickinson College students were trapped in Iceland in April and had got a week to take out. I was trapped in Paris with some of the world's disaster experts in a committee meeting. We were in Paris, and the eruption occurred, and of course all of these disaster experts couldn't get out of Paris. So this is another example of Icelandic ash, and just show you some of the spectacular data. This is the ash blowing from Iceland over Europe. This is a picture with a LIDAR image, time series at a LIDAR station in southern England, and this band here, a few hundred metres thick, is the volcanic ash in airspace over Britain. So we've got, again, wonderful methods of monitoring these things. This red-orange is the ash at one particular time coming over Britain. There's some more over there. Grounded aircraft flying into and out of Europe for 6 days. Cost £200 million a day. I was on the government advisory panel on this, and you can see here, again, just a satellite image of the ash drifting over northern Europe during this eruption. And so, as you probably know, there was complete disruption, complete chaos. And I want to show you something, if I can... Let me just do this and see if I can get this to work. Right. What you're looking at is 24 hours in the life of flights over the world. This is from YouTube. Every yellow dot is a flight. And so this is 24 hours, and you can see what the problem was. That's Europe. Those are all the flights coming in overnight from the United States. That's Europe in the middle of the day. You can see quiet at night in the United States, pretty busy in Asia. And as the flight goes out, here are all the flights coming back to the United States. The East Coast wakes up and they get on their flights and go over to California. And you can see that's a really fantastic little vignette of the modern world and our vulnerability to all sorts of stuff. And it triggers, a film like that really does trigger all sorts of thoughts about the modern world. But essentially, the reason that that Europe ground to a halt due to the Icelandic ash was very simple, that before this occurred, the way to get around of the way people had handled this problem, lots of volcanoes erupt around the world all the time, but usually airplines, the rule is if there's ash in the air, you turn round, go 180 degrees and find somewhere else to land. And that worked perfectly fine until the ash came over Europe. And then, of course, that was that. So I'm not sure if I can get out of this or not. I don't want that. I don't know what that is. It's YouTube. It could be anything. Okay, so it was very interesting. I was talking to your president during dinner tonight, and he knows one of the British ministers, Lord Adonis, who was handling this crisis in Britain. And it is a very fascinating event. I'll just leave you with this thought, that we are used to regulations, very strict regulations, and regulations on any environmental issue are extremely difficult to change. Nuclear waste, whatever it is, medical risk, anything. So changing, often regulations in the environment can be based on very out-of-date science, and the regulations themselves may bear no simple relationship to the understanding of the science now, but they're very, for all sorts of good reasons, they're very difficult to change. Now, when 20 British Airways flights were going towards Britain, and the CEO of British Airways said, "We're coming and we're landing pretty well," then there's a bit of a crisis because the regulations said you can't fly through the ash. So Lord Adonis, the British minister at the time, and other European ministers got together with airline companies, airline manufacturers, and with the air traffic controls. And over a weekend, they changed 20 years of regulation immediately. And then the flights could come in. Now, whether you think that's a good thing or a bad thing is a completely different matter, but that's what happened. And they went to a new regulation which the science is not up to testing. So I'll leave you with that thought about the societal implications of air flights and volcanoes. Thank you very much.
We're now going to begin the question and answer session. So if you have a question, please raise your hand and wait for the microphone to reach you before speaking.
Steve, you've been busy traveling, so you may have not have heard this, but yesterday President Obama had to cut short his trip to Indonesia because of the eruption. What kind of eruption is going on over there right now?
In Mount Merapi, which is very like Montserrat, and you've probably read in the newspapers there's been some deaths, unfortunately, around the volcano. So that's been very active, and I think that's, of course, spread ash in the atmosphere over Indonesia and disrupted air traffic control in a very similar way. And, of course, that's the real point. Of course, as Asia grows and we get more flights, then they're going to be more and more susceptible to this sort of disruption. I should say one thing about Merapi, because being in an interdisciplinary college, I should say that in Mount Merapi, one of the big issues is that the deaths were nothing really to do with the ability of science to forecast the volcano or even science to play a big role. The deaths were much more to do with the belief systems of the people who live around Mount Merapi. So you may have heard that there was a shaman or what's called a gatekeeper who was the people living around the volcano thought that there was a spirit living in the volcano, and the shaman was the gatekeeper, the person who gave advice. Now, he actually did give advice for people to leave, but not everybody left. But it just highlights that when you're dealing with these sorts of crises, it's the human issues which often come into play. So in the Iceland ash crisis, it's the interaction of CEOs of airline companies, engine manufacturers, and governments which play the big role. It's their interactions which almost decide what happens rather than the science.
Hi, I have a question. That is it possible to proactively drill at least at some of the selected volcanoes to ventilate it before it blows out?
Why? Good question. If you take the thermal energy of the lava dome you see in Montserrat in terms of power output of nuclear reactors, it's about 25 nuclear reactors worth of power. So the energy and power in these systems is just so vast that the idea of engineering a solution is very rarely feasible. There's very, very special circumstances where you can do you might be able to do engineering by pumping hot water onto the front of a rather fluid lava, and there seems to be some evidence that happens. But by and large, you really can't do anything about it. You just have to get out of the way. We're like the weather in the sense that we've got a stochastic complex system. And as I mentioned with this hysteresis curve, we've got inherent unpredictability. When you have these sorts of, when natural systems have this sort of, bendy behavior and they can jump from one state to another, those systems are extraordinarily hard to predict, if not impossible. So at some level, they're inherently unpredictable. At another level, they are predictable. You can see patterns, as I explained. So I think we're a bit like the weather forecasters. The reason that we can't do as good a job as the weather forecasters is they continually get updated with information. And so they can measure things all the time. And big weather systems, hurricanes, they may have 10 a year. We just don't have enough volcanoes erupt. Bitterly disappointed about this. We clearly don't have enough volcanoes erupting around the planet to have enough data to develop really strong predictive models. I think that's the reason.
Yes. Hi, thanks very much for your talk. I have a social science question. Most of the disaster literature in the social sciences is about short-term single events. And I'm wondering, as a scientist, for example, in Montserrat, which is now into year 15 of a disaster, if there are problems in terms of communication with local populations and how that changes over the course of
yes,
a disaster.
That's a really good question. I could easily give you an hour's talk on some of the issues that surrounding that, but I think the in long-term chronic conditions like in Montserrat and perhaps in Merapi now, maybe, but certainly the longer term, then it is really very difficult because populations soon change their attitude to the risk very dramatically. When the Montserrat first started to erupt, I can just do it by a sort of anecdotal point, that when it first started to erupt, most people were terrified. They'd never seen a volcano before. And almost everybody wanted to evacuate. Once they got used to the volcano and thought they understood it, although they didn't really necessarily understand it that well, but they thought they understood it, then it became part of their life and they became much more, risk tolerant. So I'll give you the story that there was one day, this was about 3 years into the crisis, we were at the cricket ground on Montserrat, and all the scientists were watching some spectacular explosions and lightning, and we were all watching those, and there was a local cricket match, and all the locals were watching the cricket, ignoring the volcano, and are much more interested in the results of the cricket, and that sort of captures the sort of changes of attitude which develop over a very long-term crisis. But there's all sorts of issues like denial and, political manipulations and so forth which come into play. So it's a very, very rich and interesting field. Don't know if that completely answered your question, but that's a...
I have a hypothetical question. Since we have global warming and there's going to be a great weight distribution over the Earth, how will this affect volcanoes and earthquakes? Do you have any idea? Maybe it's denial.
With the global warming issue, I don't think there's any physical basis for thinking that there would be any tangible effects on the rates of volcanism and earthquakes, except that in a much longer term, there's really quite convincing evidence that deglaciation triggers an onset of volcanism. So when Iceland deglaciated 10,000 years ago, the geological evidence shows that there was an outburst of volcanism. And the way that worked is, just like in the beginning of the talk, the ice melts away, the pressure down in the deep earth goes down, and so it melts, and we get more volcanic eruptions. And it could be, too, there's been some speculation that volcanoes have a lot of carbon dioxide in them, and so when there's an outburst of, at the end of the last glacial, there's an outburst of CO2, that creates a greenhouse gas, and therefore that created global warming and had a feedback to accelerate the end of the ice age. So I think that's probably the only place where there seems to be some evidence of a really big effect. Otherwise, it's not very clear that... It may be very marginally has an effect, but there's not anything... There's no really compelling argument. The main reason of... One of the interesting things is that the rate of increase of disasters globally is commonly linked to global warming. That may be more hurricanes, more typhoons, more floods. But actually, the rates of increase of volcanic disasters and earthquake disasters is also increasing, and that's principally because of the increasing vulnerability of a growing world population and megacities growing up. So disentangling the effects of global warming from increasing vulnerability is a difficult thing to do, and certainly vulnerability is a big, very big factor.
We have time for one more question. With the Icelandic plates continuing to come apart, as you said they are, can we expect to see more volcanoes like the one we've seen recently? And if so, how do you monitor that kind of action?
That's a nice controversial question because the volcano that's just erupted, which I'm going to, I'm not sure I'm going to try and pronounce. It begins with E anyway, it's erupted four times historically, and three times of the it's been followed very closely by an eruption of a much bigger volcano called Katla in Iceland. And there's been a lot of debate about whether that's coincidence or there's a relationship between one volcano erupts, it upsets its neighbour, and it erupts. I suppose the honest answer is we don't know. But there has been that link. And so that's been a concern that this other bigger volcano might erupt in the next year or two. Okay.
The Dickinson College Award in memory of Joseph Priestley includes a citation and a copy of an engraving by George Stoddard from the original statue of Dr. Priestley by Francis John Williamson. The original statue, of which we have this fine replica here, can be found in the town square in Birmingham, England, and was dedicated in 1874 to mark the 100th anniversary of Priestley's discovery of oxygen. Priestley Award, as I mentioned before, was first presented at Dickinson in 1952 and has been presented each year since then to a distinguished scientist honored for discoveries that contribute to the welfare of humankind, and we clearly saw your relationship to that this evening. Professor Sparks, I am pleased to present to you the Dickinson College Award in memory of Joseph Priestley in recognition of your extraordinary achievements. Professor Edwards will read the citation.
The Priestley Award is presented by Dickinson College in memory of Joseph Priestley, discoverer of oxygen, to a distinguished scientist whose work has contributed to the welfare of humanity. The Priestley Award, first presented in 1952, recognizes outstanding achievement and contribution to our understanding of science and the world. The 2010 recipient is Stephen Sparks for his work in the fields of igneous petrology and volcanology, particularly his contributions to improving our understanding of the physical and chemical dynamics of volcanic systems.
Thanks. Thanks very much. Okay, thank you. What's up, Ben?
Let me thank you all for being here tonight, and please join us now for a reception outside in the lobby, and that you congratulate personally Professor Sparks. Thank you.